This MSU Wanderlust Friday Forum on Populism features Professor of Political Science Nicole Ray, Dean of Montana State University's College of Letters and Science. It was recorded 3 days after the midterm elections on November 9, 2018, at the Bozeman Public Library. Dean Ray is introduced by Bob Hawks.
It is for me a real pleasure to be able to ask Dean Ray to come before us today. He's the current Dean of Letters and Science, and most of you probably know that that is a representation of a lot of the colleges at the university. More than half of the university is caught up in that leadership that Dr. Ray was hired to offer. He has come to us today to speak of populism and beyond. It's a bit of an open presentation. He came to Bozeman, it was in, I believe, 2012, in a national selection process through the university system to head up our Letters and Science division. He had formerly taught at quite a contrasting institution to ours, and that was Florida International University in Southern Florida, having been there since 2008. Dr. Ray's scholarship is centered on American and European politics and political parties, institutions. He is credited with 5 books on the subject, so he's our real local source of information with regard to the academic side of the equation, at least. Dr. Ray holds his doctorate in politics from Oxford University, was an undergraduate in politics at Edinburgh University, and perhaps in this time when farmers have a great level of popularity in the state of Montana, it surprised me to say that Dr. Ray comes off of a farm on the east coast of Scotland, and so he is well-grounded in this community, having had that experience. So let's give Dr. Ray a Montana welcome this morning.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I think those of you who've seen me before have usually seen me introducing people or talking about how great the College of Letters and Science is, and I'm always happy to do that because that's my job. But I really appreciate an opportunity to talk here about a topic that relates to my own research and my own work, much of which has been concerned with political parties, party coalitions, and American political history, particularly in the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st. So, populism. Much has been said about populism in the United States, particularly since the 2016 election. And I think that when this topic was suggested, I was very interested to talk about it. And so this morning we'll think a little bit more about what populism means. I will argue that it has a long history in the United States in various manifestations. I'll talk a little bit about where it comes from. I'll talk a little bit about party coalitions, which I think are very important, particularly party coalitions since about 1980 and how those have changed over the past almost 40 years. And I think the changes in those coalitions explains a lot of what's going on in American politics today. A definition of populism. Justice Stewart's famous remark about pornography, he couldn't define it, but he knew it when he saw it. But I think this is as good a definition as any from historian Michael Kazin, which was quoted in Populist Explosion, a very good, sharp book, an introduction to the topic by the political journalist John Judas. A language whose speakers conceive of ordinary people as a noble assemblage, not bounded narrowly by class. They view their elite opponents as self-serving and undemocratic and seek to mobilize the former against the latter. There's been a long tradition of populist movements in America, and I'm sure that I'm omitting some, but I think these are some fairly obvious examples. The Jacksonian movement of the 1820s, led by the hero of the Battle of New Orleans, Andrew Jackson. This was almost a classic populist movement in many ways. I mean, Jackson mobilized a lower status group that felt excluded from the political system of the 1820s. The great mobilizing issue was the corrupt bargain in the 1824 election, when the Jacksonians argued the political elite stitched things up in the Electoral College to prevent Jackson from winning. And Of course, Jackson came back in 1828 and won handily, and then had a very tumultuous 8-year term, which included battles with all the other institutions in American politics, the Supreme Court, and the Bank of the United States, which he subsequently dissolved. The Know-Nothing Movement of the 1850s. This movement, so named because they had a very conspiracist view of things, and so if they were asked about their affiliation with, I think its official name was the American Party, they were supposed to say that they knew nothing, hence they became the Know-Nothings. They were a kind of a symptom of the fragmentation of the Whig Party before the Civil War, with a very narrow focus on opposition to immigration, and specifically Catholic immigration, which was just beginning to become a social factor at that time after the Irish potato famine in the 1840s. They fizzled, and the remnants were sort of swept up into the new Republican Party. Then the Populist Party of the 1890s. This was a movement which initially came out of farm recession and then sort of spread into a more urban environment to some degree. Genuinely radical, with very radical platforms in terms of state ownership of things. They argued for state ownership of railroads, national elections to elect Supreme Court justices. They had a pronounced impact on the party system in the 1890s, and in a sense took over the Democratic Party for a while. McCarthyism in the 1950s. I would say that's a dubious case, but that's not my topic here today. But the interesting thing about McCarthyism is that it spawned kind of a literature on populism, which I'll talk a little bit more about in the 1960s, which may be relevant again for our time. George Wallace in the 1960s, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two national parties. A real, genuine sort of example of populism with a real Southern flavor to it. Ross Perot in the 1990s, and then more recently, Donald Trump, who at least has espoused some populist rhetoric and themes, although the extent to which he's genuinely a populist or not, I would argue is somewhat debatable. But he's certainly capitalizing politically on some populist sentiment, for sure. These are the classic explanations that social scientists have come up with for the recurrent phenomenon of populism. There are one set basically sees populism in terms of socioeconomic stress. And that surely has been an element in almost all the populist movements that I mentioned. Some would call this sort of a more of a class-based or even Marxist explanation. There's a lively literature, for example, on the populist movement of the 1890s. There's a segment of it that is very sympathetic to the populists. Usually historians writing from a kind of socialist or Marxist bent see them as the genuine article, and that was somehow diverted by the system. There are others who sort of look at populism and always see the specter of racism. Certainly there's anti-immigrant themes that have recurred in populist movements. Fears of an other, an elite, or a group that is alleged to be the elite. And there's often an argument from sort of the first group that populist sentiment often gets diverted in this direction, that these themes aren't intrinsic to populism. And then I'm going to dial back to McCarthyism, because this spawned a very interesting literature in the 1960s from some very eminent historians and social scientists who explained populism in terms of what they called status anxiety. Groups in American society that were anxious about their social status, basically that status was declining and being surpassed by other groups. And Richard Hofstadter dubbed this the paranoid style in American politics, and he wrote a very entertaining book in the mid-60s where he sort of looked at some of the movements I mentioned previously in terms of his thesis of the paranoid style. And other intellectuals of the time who were somewhat associated with this were Semmer Martin Lipset, sociologist, another sociologist, Daniel Bell. These folks were really reacting to McCarthyism. McCarthyism shook them up. They were academics. They saw its effects. And in fact, all of them contributed chapters to an edited book called The Radical Right that came out in the early 1960s. Very much a response to McCarthyism and vestiges such as the John Birch Society, which was attracting a lot of attention at the time. We have various explanations for the phenomenon. Maybe there are elements of all three that bear on it. We can think about these as we look at the more recent manifestations of populism. It's certainly we're seeing a resurgence
of populist themes in Western democracies. This is not unique to the United States. And in fact, some of the manifestations in other countries are arguably more disturbing than here. We certainly have Brexit, Britain's withdrawal from the European Union, much of which was driven by a party called the UK Independence Party, which sort of won about 14% of the vote, I think, in the 2015 British election, and kind of led the Brexit charge. We've had now for about a decade the Front National in France as a major political force. It's more or less the opposition now in France. It's now led by Marine Le Pen, the daughter of its founder, Jean-Marie Le Pen, who is a somewhat perhaps more moderated version of her father. The rise in Germany of the Alternative für Deutschland party, a very right-wing anti-immigration party which won about 13% of the vote in the last German federal election and became the official opposition party in the German Bundestag because the two major parties were in a coalition with each other. The Five Star Movement and the League in Italy, which now is in government. Again, populist themes. We see populist parties in Austria and Eastern Europe. What's driving it? Well, I think there's general agreement that these parties result from social dislocations caused by economic change, particularly globalization. And globalization itself is a manifestation of the switch from an industrial to a post-industrial society. In almost all of these countries, the earnings gap between workers and elites has grown over the past half century. In these countries, perceptions on the part of lower status white voters or native voters of uncontrolled immigration from various places. In Europe, it tends to be more the Middle East and North Africa. In the United States, more Latin America. A perceived elite hostility to traditional values, religion, national culture. I would say religion is a much less important factor in the European context, but notice how these parties all identify themselves with the nation. UK Independence Party, Front National, Alternative für Deutschland. And of course, all of these tensions have been manifested in the rise of new parties and social movements across the G7 nations. I'm going to leave that aside for a minute now and talk about party coalitions, because I think this bears on the American context, and we see basically, I think, three majority party coalitions that form in the past 40 years. This was the classic Republican Party coalition, what I call the Reagan consensus, that basically defined the Republican Party from about 1980 to 2012. It reached its high point when Reagan got reelected in 1984, carrying 49 states and just under 60% of the popular vote. The policy agenda, resolutely anti-Soviet. This was the Cold War period, remember. Faith in free markets, tax cuts, and limited government. Free trade. Reagan signed the original free trade deal with Brian Mulroney with Canada in the 1980s, subsequently became NAFTA. And then social conservatism, or reaction against social liberal advances from the 1960s. Sometimes called the religious right, or new right. The components, business and professional class, which had always been Republican pretty much since the New Deal. Religiously observant Christians. This is the period when we first started noticing that the most important religious division in America wasn't so much between denominations, but within them, between those who were highly observant and those who were not. And then the so-called Reagan Democrats, who were white working-class Democrats, who responded very powerfully, particularly to strong anti-Soviet foreign policy and to some degree to the social conservatism. Coalition, I think, was fairly dominant presidentially, actually, from the late 60s to about 1988. You could stretch it back to 1952 if you wanted. It was never dominant below the presidential level. So dominant was the coalition that it actually pulled the other party into its orbit to some degree. By the 1990s, it was coming under pressure. The Cold War ended. It took away opposition to the Soviet Union and the hawk-dove debate vis-a-vis the Soviets as a major issue in American politics. The electorate is growing more secular. Bill Clinton also kind of stole the Republicans' clothes on economic issues. His so-called triangulation policy, basically when he said the era of big government is over, supported a largely Republican-drafted welfare reform in 1996, and negotiated the North American Free Trade Agreement. Also, the Democrats became more interventionist in foreign policy in sort of limited operations in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Haiti. And of course, Clinton is quite successful. His triangulation, he does a budget deal with the Republicans in Congress that more or less wipes out the deficits left over from the 1980s and the economy booms. But the price of his success, and this being American politics, it's always delightfully perverse, is that Congress, which had remained Democratic since the 1950s, essentially switches the other way. The Republicans win control of the House in 1994 and hang on to control of the House and Senate for 12 years. After Clinton, Bush 43, George W. Bush, essentially sets out to rebuild the Reagan coalition. And he barely manages. The same components are there, but by 2000 and 2004, he's barely able to eke out a majority with it. In fact, in 2000, he lost in the Electoral College. There's some resurgence when national security issues come roaring back to the fore following 9/11 and the subsequent Iraq War. But then it collapses again completely in Bush's second term. The Iraq War is prolonged and becomes very unpopular domestically. Bush's second term agenda policy, social security reform and immigration reform, goes nowhere. And then we have the economic slowdown and eventual collapse in September 2008. Leaves the Republican coalition in a very parlous state. So the Democratic coalition built by Barack Obama, often what referred to as the coalition of the ascendant. And what that meant is there was a coalition of rising groups in the American electorate, both in terms of demographics and political influence. And there was a fair bit of truth to that. I mean, one facet of the Obama coalition was to mobilize African Americans and growing immigrant populations to an unprecedented degree. Younger voters, educated professionals, especially professional women, and all of these components wanted to see a more interventionist federal government in select areas. The policy agenda ended the Iraq War, which he did. The bank bailout and the economic stimulus led to an economic recovery. The bailout was somewhat controversial in certain circles of the Democratic Party, but nevertheless, by Obama's second term, you had the economy in a sharply upward curve after the Great Recession. A major achievement being the Affordable Care Act, largely passed thanks to Nancy Pelosi. It cost her first run at the speakership, but she got it done. The Democrats had been seeking major health care reform for decades, and Obama was able to deliver it and bring millions of Americans into the health care system who had previously not been covered. They took climate change seriously and made some moves to address it. And of course, as parties do, advance the interests of groups that identify with them. Feminists, gay and lesbian, and the minorities and immigrants, documented and otherwise. But there were limitations. Obama won a smashing presidential electoral success in 2008. In 2012, he won, but with a slightly reduced margin, indicating that there was some backlash, as it were, against what was going on. His wins were based on strong support from growing demographic groups in the electorate. He wasn't able, despite aspiration, I think, particularly in the 2008 campaign, to overcome the political polarization and perception of government dysfunction that had become quite deeply embedded in the electorate. The Democrats were decimated in the 2010 and 2014 elections, and Republicans established a position of predominance in the U.S. House and in the states that hadn't been seen since the 20s. And the Obama administration was not able to address the economic concerns of groups that weren't benefiting from the global economy. The Obama administration was very explicitly globalist, but again, we have these groups out there that are feeling pressured about their socioeconomic situation, their status, etc. And didn't do anything really to reduce income gaps. So we have the non-ascending. Society is never static. As some groups are ascending, there are others that are not in that position. And this group, they sort of dial back to the international analysis of primarily non-college educated, white, lower, middle, and working class voters. the classic blue-collar industrial working class. They're anxious about their economic and social position. Even more than that, there are some worrying indications of declining public health among non-Hispanic white middle-aged Americans. I would refer you to an article by Nobel laureate Sir Angus Deaton and his wife, Professor Ann Case, that really first highlighted this. We're used to advances in longevity and so forth. This stopped happening for this group. Diminishing job prospects in areas hit by globalization and erosion of traditional industries and industrial unemployment, the so-called Rust Belt. These voters tend to be very concerned about uncontrolled immigration. Why? Well, because it's very easy to blame their troubles on immigration. And there's a whole economic debate about the effect of immigration on overall wages and so forth, which I'm not really going to get into. What's important for our purposes is that a significant number of these voters believe that immigration is undermining their economic position. And then also wary of perceived threats to traditional American culture and cultural icons from ascending constituencies. And this sort of hones in a little bit on the political correctness controversies that have also become part of populism. It's clear by the second term of the Obama administration that you have a significant, large, discontented group in the electorate that is very susceptible to populist themes. And so we come to Trump. Trump wins the Republican nomination essentially because the Reagan coalition isn't working. The mantras of the Reagan Republican Party, the George W. Bush Republican Party, the Mitt Romney Republican Party, they're not doing it anymore. The social conservatism is undermined by increased secularism and hyper-tolerant millennials. Americans are no longer, as a country, opposed to things like same-sex marriage. That doesn't work as an election mobilizing issue anymore. The neoconservative foreign policy, which had become almost an article of faith for Republicans from about the 70s onward, had been undermined by Iraq. That was the neocons' war. It turned into a disaster, politically, for the neocons and for the party. Interestingly, a lot of those folks who were in the vanguard for the Iraq War are now vociferous opponents of President Trump, which is kind of interesting. Tax cuts and reducing government is no longer a convincing policy to economically squeezed working middle-class voters. These folks are saying, yeah, that's not really doing it for us. We need more. What is Trump's platform? Anti-immigration? An amnesty for illegal immigrants. From the minute he came down the escalator in Trump Tower, that was up front and center. He's anti-free trade. This has been an article of faith for Republicans of the Reagan stamp. But for Trump, they're taking our jobs. The Chinese, the Europeans, even the Canadians. Opposition to political correctness. Nationalistic foreign policy. Trying to say, I'm not going all over the world looking for dragons to slay. I'm putting America first. Not the first time that's been a slogan in American politics. Also talking about extreme national security measures relating to terrorism, primarily terrorism coming from the Middle East with an Islamic stamp. Much to the horror of his opponents, it turned out that Trump's positions were better aligned with the sentiments of 2016 Republican primary voters than the Republican establishment. Although, I'm not going to get into this today, but the story of that race essentially is that Trump had his constituency and the remaining Republican constituency was divided up by a bunch of other candidates, from Ted Cruz to Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, John Kasich. Whereas Trump had this populist segment of the primary electorate all to himself. I believe there are a lot of people out there who sort of said, yeah, you know, what presidential candidate's ever given us any love? I mean, there's the key to Trump's victory, a freakish win in some ways, but he ekes out a narrow electoral college victory by switching electoral votes in the Rust Belt states. He wins the election in Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, areas that are some of the hardest hit by globalization. We shouldn't make too much of it. I mean, he wins them all with the exception of Ohio by the skin of his teeth. If you go inside those states, he actually wins them a rather different way to Republicans were winning them in the 80s. Less suburban, more small town, more rural, more in the old industrial areas, like the Mahoning Valley in Ohio, which used to be a Democratic bastion. He mobilizes the descending elements of the electorate with a populist, anti-elite, anti-free trade, anti-immigration message. And it's these economically and culturally stressed, non-college educated white voters and rural voters that put him over the top. And can't forget this, that alone wouldn't have won him the election. I mean, he held on to enough of the traditional Republican constituency to win. There was some erosion, but he basically held on to the traditional white college-educated suburban vote, to enough of it to win the election. The Democrats, well, they suffered from a tone-deaf nominee in terms of the Hillary Clinton. I think people in her campaign, for some reason, didn't send her to Michigan, and they didn't send her to Wisconsin. They sent her to Arizona. I think they sent her to Georgia, maybe. They were thinking that, right, she's going to California, I think, to raise money, because there's no way she's going to lose that. But also, I think she somehow didn't seem to be able to have a message to this constituency, which, you know, had responded quite positively to her husband 20 years earlier in the 90s. And I can only speculate as to the reasons for that. And also, she suffers because some of the groups that are most enthusiastic about Obama just aren't as enthusiastic when there's no Obama on the ballot. Minority voters and younger voters, we see a turnout drop-off from 8 and 12, which hurts the Democratic Party, and particularly in those key swing states. Well, governing as a populist. The American system isn't geared to help populists with an with a political agenda. Even when your party controls both houses of Congress, there are internal barriers, supermajority requirements, there's the courts, as President Trump has found out, can do a lot to block, unravel, delay your agenda. It's not a system that's geared to implementing a radical agenda. So the only significant legislative achievement we have is a not very populist tax cut. That really didn't help the folks who elected him. And the folks it did help don't appear to be very grateful, at least based on the results of the recent election. Also, this may be more congressional Republicans than Trump, although he could have shut this down, but the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act doesn't seem to be very populist either. Basically, more folks are at risk of dropping out of the system. Pre-existing conditions loom as a threat to getting health insurance, and it appears from the results on Tuesday that this backfired electorally. Much of the anti-immigrant measures and the security measures are blocked by courts, and there's no wall. And the ongoing Russia investigation and controversy stirred up by the president's tweets threaten the loss of focus, and his approval rating is never much more than 40%. When he was low, it sort of bottomed out in the mid-high 30s. The last year, it sort of plateaued at about 43 to 45 and seems to be very much stuck there. And that's not really a winning score, usually, for presidents facing re-election. However, maybe he delivers for the populists in other ways. The trade fights with Canada, China, and the European Union. At least one of those, he's able to claim that his strong stance led to a better deal. The other two sort of ongoing situations, which could actually damage some of his rural support in terms of losing foreign markets due to tariffs, we shall see. The ongoing attacks on the news media, the Democrats, and the anti-Trump elites. There still seems to be a resonance to that, and the rhetorical populism is being delivered, and also using the platform of the presidency to ignite new controversies to rile the base. The football players kneeling, the immigrant caravan, and then spinning the Kavanaugh confirmation in a way that really sort of heightened some of the concerns of the populist constituency. He's delivered on judges for sure. Well, he's delivered on conservative judges. I mean, whether they're Trump judges is another question, not quite the same thing. But two Supreme Court justices and at the circuit court, a lot of new, young, conservative judges were confirmed, and with the Republicans holding the Senate, there'll be more in the next 2 years. The economy booms, there's low unemployment, and even signs of rising real wages. And that is certainly rebounding to the president's benefit. In fact, the question mark may be why it isn't rebounding more to his benefit. We could also say that the president's critics in his own party have been largely marginalized. They're either now sort of loyal to the president, or they're not in Congress anymore, or won't be in Congress anymore. It's Trump's party now. So, some general observations about Tuesday's elections. The loss of the House. This was not unexpected. The average seat loss, I think, for the president's party in the first midterm is about 25 or so seats. So the Democrats bested that. I'm estimating they'll end up with a gain or a Republican loss of about 35, which is good. It's not the sort of tsunami, if you like, of 2010, where the Republicans won 63 seats, but it's a good showing and reveals some critical weaknesses in the president's coalition. The districts that switched were in the suburbs. They were generally relatively high-income, relatively high-educated districts in the Atlanta suburbs, the Philadelphia suburbs, New Jersey. There'll be a bunch in sort of Southern California, suburbia, when the counting's done. One commentator dubbed this the revenge of the rhinos, often dubbed by their enemies as Republicans in name only, but these are educated suburban Republicans, particularly women, turned out to vote against the Republican Party in this election, and that's what swung the House. The Republican gains in the Senate, this could be looked at as part of the perversity of the system, but actually if you look at where the Senate races were, this isn't so surprising. The Senate map of 2018 was extremely favorable to the Republicans. The Democrats, about 24 of the 33 seats that were up were Democrat-held seats. Many of them in states that President Trump carried, and some of them in very red territory. The three that switched, that we know for sure, Indiana, Missouri, North Dakota, are states that President Trump carried by like 20 points or more in 2016. It was always going to be an uphill slog for the incumbents to hold these seats, even in a Democratic year. And two of those incumbents had benefited from some of the worst Republican candidates of all time. In 2012, Claire McCaskill's opponent that year, Todd Akin, said outrageous things on television, and Joe Donnelly's opponent in Indiana, likewise. Also, Mitch McConnell, one of the sharpest operators in American politics, figured out where to concentrate his efforts. There were also Democrats who were vulnerable, perhaps, in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and O'Connell said, forget about those. It's a harder slog. It's going to cost a lot more money. Channel our resources into the deep red territory. And that paid off. They'll end up with 52 to 54 seats as opposed to 51 in the next Senate. The GOP lost 7 governorships. There wasn't much of a pattern to this. They lost a couple of swing states, Michigan and Wisconsin. Always good to have the governor, particularly if the election count is close, in a state. They had Pennsylvania already. The Republicans held the governorship of Ohio, which was a little bit of a surprise. They held the governorship of Iowa, which is another swing state. The election revealed that the growth in the Republican strength in rural areas was pretty much maintained. In fact, they picked up a couple of House seats in Minnesota. Minnesota was really interesting. They lost two suburban districts near Minneapolis and won two rural districts, one in the former Iron Range, northern Minnesota, which had been an ancestrally Democratic district. So the urban-rural divide is still there. Although rural simplifies a little lot. Under rural, we're also including some small cities and so-called exurbs. So what now for populism? Well, it's already started. The president will use the Democratic House as a foil, as he's used the news media. He shows up with a press conference the next day saying, hey, I won the election. And by the way, Nancy Pelosi did a great job and they should make her speaker. I don't know if Nancy Pelosi appreciated the favor. The Democrats in the House will have a decision as to how much they want to spend their time with investigations, hearings, controversies. It's very hard controlling one chamber of Congress to actually do anything. And you can put yourself in a position where you do become a foil. President Obama used the 2010 sort of Tea Party Republican class as a foil, and President Trump will try to do the same thing. Of course, he's going to try to keep his base riled up with polarizing issues. On the other hand, the question that the midterms raise is, can he win re-election with a 40-5% approval rating and unpopularity among college-educated voters in the suburbs? The election watcher Nate Silver sort of took the Tuesday results and sort of reinterpreted them on an electoral college map, and the map that comes out is pretty similar to Obama's winning map in 2012. Trump's appeal to the base, it's very vulnerable to an economic downturn. If the economy goes sour, that pulls a major leg away from his argument for re-election. We also see that governing as a polarizing president is very exhausting. For the voters, may not be for President Trump, but for us, this is exhausting. Controversy after controversy. Will the base voters tire unless the president is able to deliver concrete benefits to them, I think is a question. But ironically enough, if his base does begin to gain economically, will it make them less anxious and less receptive to populist appeals? I think I'll wrap up with a few reflections on the limitations of populism as a governing strategy. In US history, populist movements tend to burn out, go off the deep end, or get absorbed into less threatening, more pragmatic, broader-based coalitions. 1890s populism got absorbed by the progressive movement, a much broader-based movement that included the middle class that was also reformist but far less radical. Wallace's 1968 supporters became Nixon Republicans in 1972 and pretty much stayed there. Perot's fans drifted back into the Republican Party after he departed the political scene. Populism can capture a major party for a time. We've seen the example of Andrew Jackson, William Jennings Bryan, and more latterly Donald Trump. But when this happens, it can limit the party's appeal and capacity to build broad-based coalitions. American politics depends on building broad-based coalitions in a highly diverse society. So Bryan captured the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party lost the presidency 3 times simply because he could not appeal beyond the populist base as a candidate. The Trump coalition, I don't think, has much capacity to grow. He hasn't expanded Republican growth among Latinos, Asians, African Americans, despite some claims. And, I mean, younger voters on Tuesday were even more overwhelmingly opposed to Republican candidates. The future of the party, electorally, needs a broader electoral appeal than the anger of non-college-educated whites. And political parties are in the business of winning elections. Sooner or later, this lesson will be learned and they'll have to figure out a way to broaden the coalition again. Nevertheless, this constituency will remain a volatile element, receptive to populist appeals, as long as their anxieties, and particularly the economic anxieties, aren't addressed. So, that's all I have to say, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Yes.
The question was, do I think the centrist Republicans will rise up? I guess there's sort of a flip answer to your question, which is what centrists? Because actually the ranks of Republican moderates in the House have been depleted by the election. The folks who lost tended to be more on the non-Trump side of the party, sort of suburban moderates. And also, to some extent, in the Senate, you lose Bob Corker, Jeff Flake. The senators that are coming in are probably going to be more of a sort of Trumpian stamp. But nevertheless, had the Republicans lost 60 seats in the Senate, I think questions would have been asked about Trump's viability as a candidate, and it would certainly have encouraged a challenge in 2020. And there are folks out there who might think about it. John Kasich, for one. Senator Ben Sasse, perhaps, from Nebraska. But I think something is going to have to go more awry in the next 12, 18 months for that to happen. Politicians want to win. Republicans want to win. If the Trump formula becomes a recipe for certain defeat, then other options will begin to open up. But for the time being, I think his position within his party looks very strong and secure.
It's my impression that when you're talking about populism, that there is a larger role of racism, either latent or, as it is now, just blatant. And it seems to me that that is a very strong appeal to populists,
and
has been.
Certainly, there have been shades of it in almost all populist movements. Less so, I mean, Andrew Jackson, I don't think so much, but...
Well, he was against Indians, right.
Right, that's true. And the whole context of the time was very different. I would put it this way. I think populism can often get diverted into sort of more racist appeals. And the case of the 1890s populists is interesting because they went in several directions. There were the really hardcore economic populists, quasi-socialist, non-partisan league folks. They either became socialists or they became very radical progressives. Particularly in the southern states, there were some populists who actually turned into segregationist sort of race-baiting politicians. Tom Watson in Georgia started out as a genuine populist and ended up as a segregationist. Even more ghastly figures like Pitchfork Ben Tillman, who was a vicious racist.
Well, Wallace,
populist themes.
Yeah, Wallace's main appeal was racism. George Wallace.
Certainly, backlash to the Civil Rights Revolution played a part in his appeal. I don't think it was the whole story.
And now, the last 10 years since Obama was president, it's been blatant racism.
I think blatant racism needs to be called, but I would say this. I think you have to be careful about branding whole sections of the population as racist, because I think then that can kind of shut down the argument. The blinders go up. Well, if you're calling me a racist, then I don't want to talk to you anymore. It's something that has to be treated with a certain degree of sensitivity. But obviously, we have to call out the most blatant examples where it happens.
To Lauren, what degree was Bernie Sanders doing a populist campaign?
I think to quite a large degree he was. In the pure sense of economic populism, I mean, that was his appeal. What we don't know, of course, is we never saw a Trump-Sanders race. If Sanders could have competed with Trump for the votes of those voters suffering from economic anxiety and stress. Certainly it's a major theme in his campaign. I think we'll see if Elizabeth Warren runs in 2020, if she can try to burst the president's populist balloon to some degree. As I said, populism covers a wide variety. But I would certainly say, I mean, Sanders espoused some very populist themes.
Has any president before ever governed exclusively for his base and not tried to expand the appeal to the rest of the country or tried to unite the country at all?
Let me think. I can't think of an example. Although I would say this, that politics has become more of what you might call a base plus game. I think it was Karl Rove who sort of pioneered that idea that you can win elections if you mobilize your base to the max and then sort of add a little bit in the middle. And so base mobilization, I think, has been a bigger part of candidate strategies for about the last quarter century. And I think some of that is due to growing polarization in the electorate, which is something of a separate debate from what I've talked about today, but is a very lively debate among political scientists. The parties are more polarized, the voters are more polarized, so you motivate the polarized first. I think it means that candidates are a little less likely to move to the middle after the primary, which used to be the classic strategy, or it's made it harder for them to move to the middle. That in a sense, too much has been said to get the nomination, and then the move to the middle becomes much more awkward. So, yes, I mean, I think with President Trump, that he's taking the strategy probably not just as an electoral strategy, but as a governing strategy. And I think we've seen some of its limitations.
If Obama lost to Mitt Romney in 2012, would we have seen this wave of populism?
I think we would, but it might have taken a rather different form. I'm not sure that the platform that Governor Romney ran on in 2012 would have addressed the anxieties of the constituencies susceptible to populism any more than President Obama did in his second term. There was a certain tone deafness in the Republican establishment that we can kind of take these folks for granted. We'll talk about social conservatism and tough foreign policy, and that'll be enough. And I think it ceased to be enough. I think it might have taken a different form. It might have been the Democratic Party that was sort of more divided over populism, perhaps, in opposition, if that had been the case. But I think the anxieties are strong enough that they would have surfaced in some way, but not quite the same way.
How has the influence of foreign actors affected populism?
We know that President Putin has been active in elections across the G7 in some way. How effective that's actually been, I'm skeptical. The effectiveness has just been in sort of raising controversy about it and undermining legitimacy of the process more than anything else. It's mischievous. It's deliberate mischievousness and kind of poking in the eye is how I see it. waiting for the special prosecutor to issue his report, I don't see it having changed the result anyplace. It may not just be Russia that's doing some meddling. There may be others too. I just haven't seen it change an outcome in any way. It sure gets a lot of attention, and it sure helped undermine the legitimacy of the processes, I suppose, which I suspect is probably the goal.
How does populism affect Montana politics, and what do you see the future of Montana politics?
In a senior administrative position in a state university, I have to approach this topic rather gingerly. But I would say this. Montana is a state where you have booming pockets of growing affluence that are doing rather well, and you have other parts of the state that are not doing as well economically. And I don't think I need to spell out the places for this audience. And I think that has political impact to an extent. If you look at the pattern of election returns, we have post-industrial areas in the state. We have rural areas that are economically stressed. And then we have towns that are booming because they're in the right place at the right time. I think this is characteristic of many of the states of the West. There's a political pattern that emerges out of that. It's going to influence politics in our state. Politics in the Mountain West has always had kind of a populist tone to it. The long tradition in Montana of sort of being against big corporations, big companies, a lot of suspicion, which kind of transcends party lines still here in a way it doesn't some other places. Outside, the influence of outside actors and campaign financing has more of a resonance in our state than in many other states.
Under populism, you have that social conservatism, and you have the religious element. So how does that square with, say, a president who lies?
I would make a distinction. Religious and social conservatives are not quite the same thing. There are some social conservative issues that have a religious resonance and some that don't. This is a tough issue for religious conservatives. There are some who genuinely are conflicted about wrestling with some of the president's statements and his conduct and supporting his agenda. And there are others who have gone for the president hook, line, and sinker regardless. And I think it's created a tension among religious conservatives. And I think also religious conservatives, the more thoughtful religious conservative leaders, I think are wrestling with the idea of their relationship with the Republican Party and whether that still benefits them in terms of their objectives as religious leaders. So I think your question, you know, has pointed out another tension in the Republican coalition. I haven't seen figures from the midterms on religious observance on the vote yet. They might tell us something about what's going on.
As you pointed out, that one of the alleged successes of the party was the tax bill that was passed. And I was surprised that no one has brought up that this leaves us with this enormous deficit and what impact that will have on entitlements, Social Security, etc. Do you think people don't care about deficits?
Yes. No, I think they do care. The trouble with deficits as an issue is that it's usually the bad consequences aren't here yet. They're somewhere down the road. And I think that's a tougher political argument. I think it was interesting to see that the Democratic campaigns for Congress, rather than focusing on the deficit or potential future deficits, narrowed in on health care, which was something much more immediate to voters. The danger of losing coverage, of being excluded from coverage for pre-existing conditions, going back kind of to the status quo ante before the Affordable Care Act, that had much more immediacy for voters. The problem with deficits, and particularly for Democrats, that should be a Republican issue. And so Democrats are always wary of campaigning on deficits because it may put them in the position of having to cut spending for things that they believe passionately we need to spend on. So they're much happier for Democrats to make arguments based on health, loss of health care, than it is for Republicans. The way that the tax cut passed is because you can get around the supermajority requirements by using reconciliation and saying it's a finance bill. The filibuster is, although it's been set aside for judges, and cabinet appointees is still a very potent legislative weapon.
I was surprised by your definition of populist. I always thought of it having more to do with a personality or character. If the Republican nominee had been someone different, would this populism likely manifest itself, or would it have stayed underneath the surface for some more time?
I think it was bound to surface. President Trump's intuition was that it was there, and that it was something that he could use to win the nomination and the election. He has a way of being able to, I guess, touch the exact spots that this constituency feels anxious about. Also, the way that he uses media is in some ways somewhat revolutionary. I mean, never has so much attention been given to a Twitter account. And, I mean, this raises the issue of the president's relationship with the media. What happens is the president puts something on Twitter, the media report. I mean, I'm not on Twitter. I'm not going to be on Twitter. I'd spend way too much time on Twitter, so I'm not on Twitter. I have other stuff to do. I don't have to be on Twitter to know what the president's tweeting, because the media tells me straight away what his tweet of the day is. And then it's echoed and echoed and echoed and echoed. This is a new way of communicating. It's worked brilliantly for the president in some ways. In other ways, once you're president, in a sense, and you're still tweeting, and you're still using Twitter to sort of provoke, well, let's put it this way, it doesn't look very presidential. And I think he's paid for it. I mean, I think a lot of the folks who revolted in the House in the elections, they're fed up with the tweets. When you talk to voters and say, oh, God, I wish he'd stop tweeting. I think once you're beyond the campaign, I'm not sure tweeting is a great governing strategy for a president. In fact, I tend to doubt that it is.
What do you think is the university's responsibility to its students to promote voting or even promote voting registration?
Well, as a university, we are in the business of educating future citizens, and therefore we want to promote good citizenship, and voting is fundamental to good citizenship. I mean, we want informed, active, participating citizens. We often write that into our value statements and plans and so forth. I see that as part of our mission. And we have to be a little careful. We can't let that become partisan in any way. We have done things. I think our president has been encouraging of sort of improving poll access for students on campus. And so I think very much want our students to be active and to be informed and to participate as future citizens of the United States. And I taught a political parties class right after the election, which I was dreading it in some ways, because I said, oh my goodness, they're just going to use the class to sort of fight partisan arguments. And that didn't happen. In fact, I was very proud. The students were overwhelmingly thoughtful and interested, and not so much wanting to rehash partisan arguments, but to want to understand political developments and how we came to be where we are, which was the point of the class. So I was very encouraged by that.
In Congress, how are they going to deal with foreign actors who, because of Trump, I think, go far to the right? And I'm thinking more or less Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil and Duterte in the Philippines, shoot on sight. Somebody said he's a criminal. Looks like one, so kill him. And by the other hand is, of course, Saudi Arabia and the state-sponsored killing of Khashoggi in the embassy in Istanbul. How should Congress deal with that?
I think the Saudi issue is a little different because we're not dealing with a democratic system. We see populist foreign leaders getting elected. They face perhaps some of the same difficulties in governing as a populist. The European situation bothers me a little more. I think we're seeing some parties in Europe that make the Trumpian Republican Party look rather benign almost by comparison. And these parties, they're not getting majorities, but they're getting more than 1 in 10 of the citizens on a regular basis and sort of entrenching themselves. And some of these parties are not particularly shy about indulging in pretty explicit Islamophobic racist rhetoric. That worries me. Brazil has had a long period of fairly stable democracy and growth, and I'm not a Latin Americanist, but when I see polarizing leaders in a country that has come a long way since I was a teenager and they had military dictatorships, yes, I think there's concern there that we don't want to see a regression to sort of caudilloism in our hemisphere. So I hope that those elections don't indicate that.
Thinking about David Cameron and Brexit, could there ever be a referendum in the US? Or has there ever been a referendum in the US?
Plenty at the state level, at the local level. Yeah. Nationally, there's no mechanism for it. And in a way, a national referendum in the U.S. would be very un-Madisonian. The American system is geared to making people think again and again and again. Are you absolutely sure you want to do this? We've seen very divisive initiatives in various states over the years, some of which were kind of harbingers of national debates on immigration. Take one issue, or LGBT rights to take another issue. But nationally, I don't see it happening. There's no constitutional provision for it. And it's a fairly recent development in Britain. Like, I'm old enough to remember the very first one in 1975. And people said, you shouldn't govern by referendum. Well, maybe there was some wisdom in that. No. Thank you very much. It's been fun.
You have just heard an MSU Wanderlust Friday Forum on populism given by political science professor Nicole Ray, dean of Montana State University's College of Letters and Science, which was recorded 3 days after the midterm elections on November 9, 2018. Friday forums are held on the second Friday of the month at noon in the large conference room at the Bozeman Public Library. They are free and open to the public. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for KGVM 95.9 FM, Gallatin Valley Community Radio.